I'm Christopher Lydon, out on the unequal landscape of American wealth and power with the economist James K. Galbraith, who says it's no coincidence that we have the most extreme inequality and the closest thing to a crash since the Great Depression got underway in 1929. But what is the organic connection between equality and a secure prosperity? This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jamie Galbraith, you're a scientist in this field, but speak as a citizen, just roughly from the start. What is your ideal standard of equality in our society, and why? And then how would we accomplish it? But what are you aiming for?
Well, one thing I think is that scientists should not be too portentous about how they describe themselves. I would say that I'm an applied statistician, which is a humbler sort of thing. And I would say, in response to your question, that societies and countries should keep the extent of inequality that they tolerate under control. It's like everything else. The system works better when it is regulated and functions in a moderate way over a long period of time. You allow inequality to run out of control, you are going to crash. And that's what happened. It's what happened in 1929, 1930, and it's what's happened in 2007, 2009.
What kind of inequality are you talking about? People talk wealth and the ownership of the 1% or the 10th of 1% or the 100th of 1%. They talk CEO salaries in relation to workers. We talk about inequality in the world between us and Chad. Where do you start worrying about it?
Well, you can measure practically anything and come to some understanding of its inequality. And my approach to the field has been is opportunistic, is to take the evidence that exists and attempt to build systematic measures across countries and through time. In terms of the United States, it's a country which is very rich in economic information. One tends to focus on the inequalities of income. That's revealed to us in tax data, inequalities of pay, which is revealed to us in earnings data. Both of those, they answer slightly different questions, but they're both very useful constructs.
And how about ownership?
Ownership is a little more difficult because you don't have a register of ownership that enables you to, you know, make those kinds of measurements on a consistent basis. It's also, when you look at wealth, you can talk about financial wealth, which is extremely unequal, but you can also talk about wealth as a claim on income. And if you add in the value of people's the housing that they own, and particularly the value of the Social Security that they will receive when they're older, then the wealth measures become substantially more equal than they appear when you just look at the financial measures.
Jamie Galbraith, if Rip Van Winkle came back after 30 years, say, and said, something's changed around here, how would you introduce him to the new realities?
After only 30 years, making the turning point in the early 1980s, the major difference is that from the Second World War up to that point, we had fairly balanced economic expansion in the United States. It had a very strong component of wage-led growth. After the 1980s, all of that was gone, and we've basically expanded only on the strength of credit markets, on the strength of bank lending, on the strength of stock market bubbles. And this has been wave after wave, which have now come to grief.
Make the connection with trophy houses, luxury advertising in the New Yorker magazine, but also squalor at the lower levels, declining investments in public education, for example. Connect some of these dots.
Well, sure. Let's go back to the early 1980s when we sharply reduced tax rates on upper income people. And even in 1986, in a tax reform that had some progressive aspects to it, continued this process. What happened then? I think two things happened. One is that there was a very strong tax incentive to put your money in housing. And that was because mortgage interest remained deductible and no other form of interest did. So people who wanted to take out loans did so through housing. And people who got a windfall from the tax Cutts also invested in mansion building, and there was been a great deal of that ever since. A second thing is that when you reduce the tax rates on personal incomes, people who controlled corporations and controlled their own compensation as executives had a strong incentive that wasn't there before to transfer income from the company to themselves, to pay themselves much more. And so you had an executive compensation boom, and that also leads in the direction you just described.
I'm just thinking in the longest terms, and in maybe personal terms too, that the history of the post-war period I grew up in, and you too, I think, was a clear path out of the extremes of poverty and wealth that we, you know, we read about in the first Gilded Age in America. It was in the direction of expanding economy for sure, but also expanding equality up to the 1970s. What happened? I blinked, and suddenly we're in a different country.
I think that's an exaggeration. The Reagan administration transformed the economic rhetoric of the country. It did not successfully transform all of the economic institutions that had been created in the New Deal and the Great Society. It simply didn't. They are, in many cases, still there.
Which ones notably?
Social Security and Medicare, two of the most important ones. Medicaid, too. What do these institutions do? They protect a very large part of the American population from the grinding poverty that it experienced in the earlier part of the 20th century. These are very highly successful programs. They remain under threat, under challenge, but they are still important bulwarks of our nation. I would point to the system of higher education as well, particularly public higher education, very much stressed at the moment, but still a very important and powerful piece of the national framework.
Yeah, they're still there. But put it in the longer context, even of your own famous family. Your father, John Kenneth Galbraith, he coined the phrase the affluent society, which is really about, in his view, private affluence and public squalor. That was back in the 1950s, which looks now not just like a boom time, which it was, but a high time for equality, even social democracy in American terms. Something changed.
Well, I think if you go back and look at the affluent society, it paints the 1950s, the period it described, in a much darker light. And I think there is a tendency on the American left to romanticize that period, which was a period when we had not made any of the progress, for example, toward civil rights that we have made since, toward women's rights, toward all kinds of – we were much more – tolerant and progressive society in important respects than we were then. So I would be a little careful about that comparison. I think what happened was that in the 1960s, at the time when we were young, and into the early 1970s, there was a strong momentum for building stronger social institutions, more egalitarian and more progressive social institutions. And in the 1980s, that disappeared and the initiative passed to the other side. And for the last 20 or 30 years, progressives have been very much on the defensive. That doesn't mean we have nothing to defend. I think we have very important things that we need to continue to acknowledge and to protect. And failing to do that, writing them off at this stage, which is something, by the way, that we are in serious danger of doing, would lead to really harsh consequences down the road.
Describe the real dangers as you see them.
As soon as this election is over, no matter who it wins it, we are going to start hearing about the need for a bipartisan compromise to cut Social Security benefits. This is as sure as anything I can tell you. And it will be presented as some kind of modest proposal to protect the fiscal solvency and so forth of the Social Security program. It's utter nonsense. The purpose and effect of the cuts that are coming will be to reduce the living standard of the future elderly by very substantial amounts over time. If we allow this to happen, and particularly if we allow the Democratic Party to concede the necessity of it happening, we will be committing a crime against the future in important ways. We will be returning tomorrow's elderly to a state of distress that they have, you know, to a very substantial extent been able to avoid in recent decades.
Come back to the standard of equality itself. It seems to me that in an imperfect world that I grew up in, the vague understanding of non-economists surely was still that a rising egalitarian democracy was part of the American story, and that democracy and economic equality were somehow linked or associated. Not absolute, but it was part of the game. How much of that has been lost, and how would we get it back?
Well, a great deal of that has, in fact, been lost. I think we can say that clearly. What has happened is that our political structure is now entirely dependent upon small numbers of people with large amounts of money. And that's true of both parties. And the kinds of, to use one of my father's phrases, countervailing forces that were present a generation ago are no longer nearly as strong as they were. Mm. True of trade unions and true of other kinds of civic organizations. That is a consequence of allowing inequality of wealth and power, in this case, to get out of hand. And I think that is very definitely should be at the top of any civic agenda.
Mm. What connection do you draw, Jamie Galbraith, between the polarization of incomes and wealth in this country and the collapse of 2008 that we're still living with?
Well, that's something you can track very clearly in the data. The build-up to the collapse of 2008 showed a substantial increase in the concentration of incomes, in part because bankers were paying themselves extravagant fees for peddling bundles of fraudulent mortgages to German pension funds and such like, and part because out there in parts of the country where credit was fueling housing construction, southern Florida, southern California, you can see the effects of this in the data in terms of the incomes that were being paid in the construction industry. You can pick up exactly what was happening. And the collapse reveals that this was a type of income which was very substantially based on accounting fraud. It was something which was a consequence of the deregulation and desupervision of the financial sector that had been going on for 15 or 20 years, but which led to practices that were truly catastrophic. That sense of, not only in the sense of ruining the people who were directly affected, who took out mortgages that they could never hope to pay, largely on false premises from their lenders, but also in ruining the very large part of the American middle class that had equity in their homes and then expected to be able to draw some of that equity for retirement purposes later on in life, and who now discover that they don't have any equity in their homes, that they're actually insolvent, that their homes are worth less than the mortgages that they have on them, and that they cannot. The only way they could escape that is by walking away, which is a very hard thing for many people to do. So you've had a situation here. I think if you're looking at the consequences of the collapse of 2008, the thing to bear in mind is that many people who were not involved at all, who did nothing, didn't take out a mortgage, didn't take out a home equity loan, but were simply leading their lives, have found themselves swept up and financially very substantially destroyed by the consequences of this.
By the loss of the value of houses that they weren't either buying or selling, they were just living in.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. You're pointing to this intersection of the inequality issue and the realities of the finance economy that we live with. Mitt Romney's one-time partner in Bain Capital makes the argument in a book that will be forthcoming during the campaign that we need more inequality to make the finance system work. We should double the reward for risk takers, he calls them, to pump innovation and new technology into new jobs and new iPhones, new MRIs for consumers that will benefit and be grateful in the long run. It raises the question that I kind of answer, what is the right reward for risk in this economy? And how did it get so high already?
Well, it's interesting that a private equity guy is making this argument, because it is not as though private equity guys are in the business of designing iPhones. Steve Jobs was not a private equity guy. Private equity guys are in the business of basically restructuring corporations and taking as much for themselves as they can get. It's the scavengers. role, not a creator's role. Societies can do risk-taking in lots of different ways. The United States has a very good record of providing core innovations through a variety of public and private institutions. One can look back at Bell Labs, but we can also look back at the government laboratories that from the Manhattan Project to the Information Technology Revolution, these things have a very strong public component. So it is not the case that by liberating financiers to make as much money as they would like, that you get the kind of technical innovations that this gentleman is trying to confuse us with. And in fact, innovation in the financial sector famously accomplishes nothing of the kind. Innovation in the financial sector exists mainly to evade public regulations. That is to say, the public decides, the government decides on behalf of the public that certain things are dangerous, like issuing mortgages that will not be repaid, or issuing mortgages that no sensible private investor would ever choose to hold because the ultimate borrower is not a good credit risk. And the private sector then figures out a way to sell those mortgages to the final investors anyway, taking fat fees and in a situation in which ultimately there are going to be massive losses, but they will be felt by, let's say, pensioners in Norway or other innocent parties who trusted the AAA rating given to those instruments by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. There is, I think, no good reason why we should allow that process to continue. It's obviously, in fact, it obviously has already not only already caused an enormous amount of damage, but also we would already have cleaned it up if it were not for the decision of the government under Bush and continued under Obama to prop up the financial institutions that were responsible in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to prevent a panic, quite another thing to leave the executives in place and to allow them to continue to pay themselves exorbitant bonuses and to continue to lobby the government for freedom from regulation, which they have done merrily over the last 2 or 3 years.
That's the case against the special favor for risk takers. What about the inequality argument itself? That argument out of Bain Capital is that inequality is good for us. And it's fascinating at least to have it out there on the table. Not exactly with Mitt Romney's name on it, but it's his backer and his friend, the guy he brought into the business. I mean, I'm sure that's the way they think. What's our answer?
Oh, I would give as much publicity to that argument as possible if I were on the advising President Obama's campaign. But if I were advising President Obama's campaign, I would also be saying you've got to have some serious, not just a rhetorical, but some serious riposte. You've got to be squarely on the side of reducing inequality. And that, unfortunately, we don't see. That's a problem. We have for there to be a real alternative, the side that presents that alternative has to have a coherent and serious program that it's advancing. It's got to align itself with the values that Americans, I think, do in fact share on this question. Americans, I think, are ambivalent. They want an enterprise economy which rewards people for taking initiative and for doing things, and they're right to want that. But they also want a secure economy that provides a stable foundation from which people can make investments in education, can make and can enjoy reasonably comfortable lives, and they're right to want that too, but we do not see a strong advocacy of that, and we do not have a real, as I say, a powerful, a robust, a brave counterweight to someone like Governor Romney's friend.
We don't. You're so right. But make a stab at a start, Jamie. Where would we begin?
I would start by affirming that the institutions that the United States built up over the progressive years of the 20th century, in the 30s through the 70s, were and are sound and important institutions, uniquely American institutions, not European, not Swedish. Again, I come back to my Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and a raft of programs in which the federal government took the initiative to help build the country, whether one's looking at urban mass transit or the housing programs of the 1930s or the conservation programs, the Environmental Protection Agency. This is a framework which made sense and made progress and broadly successful outcomes. What we need to do now is to ask, what are the challenges that we face and how do we deal with them? And it's obvious that high on that list would have to be energy, climate. We have to look at unemployment. We have to look at the foreclosure debacle. And we have to look at the structure of the financial sector and the burden, the effective tax that it imposes on the rest of economic activity. Like, that's a half a dozen things. But it seems to me that if you focused on those things and made clear that you were connecting to the problems that people face now and that they know that we are all going to face in the future, you could develop an attractive, coherent alternative to the current politics. But we're not doing that.
And why don't we?
I can't speak to the president's motives, but you have to observe that when he constructed his financial team, he drew almost entirely from people who were closely connected to the financial sector, which is a traditional behavior of both political parties. But when you have your Treasury Secretary comes from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is essentially an institution that regards the major commercial banks as its clients, when your chief economic advisor is, again, very closely connected to an architect of the deregulatory strategy of the Clinton administration, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, when your budget director goes off to afterwards to work as a vice president for international operations of Citigroup, this administration, like all administrations, is allowing its policy to be essentially set by people who have the interests of the financial sector firmly in mind.
You'd redirect your attention to the environment in a big way and new technology, I presume, and alternative energies. You didn't mention taxes. Would that be on your agenda?
Yes, it would be, but I think we need to understand the goal and function of the tax system. The function of the tax system is to help regulate and control the pace of economic activity, and to help determine who gets the final benefit of economic activity. I think we need a more progressive tax system. I think we've wasted there's been a lot of waste associated with the idea that if you simply cut taxes for the wealthy, they are going to generate the great society all by themselves. And it turns out, no, they don't. Most of them are innocuous. They like their yachts and they like their mansions and they live lives of opulent comfort. But this is not a good use of our larger social resources. And it also creates a politics in which a small number of people with enormous wealth have the capacity to determine the course of policy, really in both political parties, although it's notoriously so at the moment in the Republican Party. One thing I like about the United States tax system, and it's functioned well for us for many years, is the way in which the estate and gift tax has, since Teddy Roosevelt, given an incentive for wealthy people to give away their wealth, to give it to hospitals and churches and universities and foundations. I think the laws governing how those funds are used could be tightened up and improved. People should be detached from the control of their wealth sooner after they give it away than is presently the case. But those incentives should be stronger. That's a very, very effective function in American life, and it has given us institutions, including our great universities and much of our medical establishment, that no other country has. And those institutions are more stable financially than they would be if they depended solely on public funding. So I think that here is an area where the conservatives have controlled the dialogue for decades now, calling an assault on this particular form of taxation. But we should recognize it's one of the most important things that we've got, and progressives should be forthright about defending it.
In your memorandum from early 2008, before the collapse and before the election, and today, I mean, what's the drift in your own advice to people around the president and to voters, too, for that matter?
The memorandum you're referring to was written in June of 2008, and it was an attempt to get across to the campaign the extent to which their world would be overtaken by financial events. Mm-hmm. At that time, the campaign was, at least in its public dimension, largely talking about healthcare reform and a handful of other issues, but not primarily the economic and financial questions. It was clear to any serious outside observer that we were headed for a colossal meltdown that we were going to be experiencing either before or right before or right after the election, a financial events that were out of scale of our experience. And so what I did was to convene a group, and actually quite an international group, to try and develop a collective position on this that I could convey so it wouldn't be just me saying this, because there are always Cassandras out there and you don't have to pay attention to them. But this was 25 people who I thought were people of, you know, of good reputation and serious understanding of the situation. And that memorandum, so far as I know, had no impact on the on the team surrounding the president, but perhaps they already were aware of the extent of the impending disaster. In terms of where I would take that message today, I would say, look, you succeeded in warding off a complete panic. And it wasn't you, by and large, that succeeded. It was the stability of the system as a whole. And the fact that tax revenues fall very sharply, the fact that the government can run a budget deficit of 10% of GDP and has no trouble financing it, that's a clear fact. The fact that unemployment insurance is there, the fact that people can move on to disability, that their protections in place, not perfect, in fact, very imperfect, but much better than was the case in the 1930s, meant that the system did not fall apart completely. However, parts of it did fall apart, and the recovery is not going to be what you expected in 09, in 10, or in 2011. What we're seeing here is an economic machine which is fundamentally impaired. We were relying very heavily on people's ability to borrow against their houses. Guess what? They can't do that anymore. The houses continue to fall in value, and the whole mechanism for securitizing those mortgages has collapsed. So we are not going to see a recovery of the construction sector, nor should we, but it's not going to happen. We are not going to see another business boom such as we had in the 1990s. So if you want to develop a program going forward, it's not just that you should be focusing on our major problems. It's that unless you have a strategic approach that's going to last for a long period of time, you are not going to be able to develop a kind of coherent economic response to where we are. And when you start asking, okay, what's the essence of a strategic approach? You've got to begin to recognize that you have higher resource costs, higher and unstable resource costs. This is the business of $100 a barrel oil is a serious matter that isn't going to go away. And secondly, you have the incubus on the economy of this vast financial sector isn't doing anything, isn't serving any basic public purpose. And again, a strategy as opposed to simple, let's open up the valves, get rid of austerity and start spending again. A strategy to cope with where we are requires you to take some decisions about those two matters. And there's obviously big difficulty politically because these are very powerful forces in our society, the energy sector and the financial sector. You don't get more powerful than that. But unless you start facing up to the conditions that we're in, everything's going to be a disappointment from this moment, this point forward.
In a political world, Jamie, that loves simple slogans and Obama's simplest of all, like forward, what's the chance of selling something as sophisticated and also as rather bleak as your solution?
Not my problem. I grant that political people have to have a talent for these things. I do not claim to have it. I don't aspire to it. Mm-hmm. And my sense of my own role is to try to articulate things clearly and lay them out there for anybody who happens to want to pick them up.
Let's hope they do. One more crack at France. It seems to me the French voters, as they often do, have spoken in their own voice rather clearly that they don't like this austerity thing at all. And, you know, for all the trials of Strauss-Kahn and the Socialist Party, they've given a different direction to their national government. I can imagine Mitt Romney saying, there go those crazy European socialists again, and let's not do that here. But I can also imagine the left and the Democratic side of the Democratic Party taking a great deal of heart that there's been a certain clarification of the issues. What do you suppose?
I also am encouraged by the fact that the French voters rejected their previous government and cast their hopes with a new one. There is, I think, no chance that the politics of France and the politics of the United States will intersect anytime soon, nor should they. The French are embedded in an almost entirely different system and they have a very different mentality with respect to that system. But if we take some heart from it in this country, that just in general terms, progressive change is a possibility, then that would be good. That would suggest let's look to our own strengths and have some confidence in our ability to solve problems and not to be led around by the noses by a group of, let's say, arrogant plutocrats and their cronies. And we do have that. I mean, one thing you can say about it's a parallel between France and the United States is not a parallel between the left in the two countries, which I don't think resemble each other at all. But the right, the Sarkozy government, certainly the French public viewed it as a kind of small club of rich cronies. And that is something that we can recognize in lots of different places in our own political system.
Jamie Galbraith, thank you for the book, Inequality and Instability. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, Chris, thank you very much indeed.
Jamie Galbraith's new book is called Inequality and Instability. He teaches economics at the University of Texas. Mary McGrath and Aaron Wee produced and edited this conversation in Boston. Please leave your own two bits on inequality as a trend, as a political issue, in the comment section of our website, radioopensource.org. You can follow what we're up to on Facebook and Twitter as well. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.